As you turn in your Bibles to the scripture today, children grades 3 and under can go to children's church if they would like. Thank you, choir, for the message in song. By the way, not sure if you know or not, and maybe it's just trivia in the way my mind works, as you turn to Romans 14. But Glorious Is Thy Name, O Lord, was written by B.B. McKinney in 1942. Anything else significant y'all can think of that happened in 1942? Cornerstone was laid for this building. 1942. Just thought that was kind of interesting. Romans chapter 14, as we read verses 1 through 12. And as we think today about differences and love overcoming differences. Welcome those who are weak in faith, but not for the purpose of quarreling over opinions. Some believe in eating anything, while the weak eat only vegetables. Those who eat must not despise those who abstain, and those who abstain must not pass judgment on those who eat, for God has welcomed them. Who are you to pass judgment on servants of another? It is before their own Lord that they stand or fall, and they will be upheld, for the Lord is able to make them stand. Some judge one day to be better than another, while others judge all days to be alike. Let all be fully convinced in their own minds. Those who observe the day, observe it in honor of the Lord. Also those who eat, eat in honor of the Lord, since they give thanks to God. While those who abstain, abstain in honor of the Lord and give thanks to God. We do not live to ourselves, and we do not die to ourselves. If we live, we live to the Lord, and if we die, we die to the Lord. So then whether we live or whether we die, we are the Lord's. For to this end Christ died and lived again, so that he might be Lord of both the dead and the living. Why do you pass judgment on your brother or sister? Or you, why do you despise your brother or sister? For we will all stand before the judgment seat of God. For it is written, As I live, says the Lord, every knee shall bow to me, and every tongue shall give praise to God. So then each of us will be accountable to God. Perhaps this should be next Sunday, because actually October is Baptist History and Heritage Month, and I'm going to start with a Baptist story. But this particular passage also speaks to not just Baptists, but to everyone. I did say several weeks ago when William led the Sunday school lesson, when we had breakfast that morning and met together, and it was on this passage, that I might just redo what William had to say. While I have taken some things he had to say into consideration, this is not a rehashing of that Sunday school lesson. Several years ago, my friend and church historian Bill Leonard, who was at the time the dean of the Divinity School at Wake Forest University, was leading a group session on Baptists and Baptist history. If you have ever been to any of those sessions, you know that sometimes they can get rather lively and questions are encouraged, especially when Bill is speaking. He allowed time for questions, and among the questions that someone asked and that he addressed was, What do you appreciate the most about being Baptist? To which Bill smiled his typical impish kind of smile. If anyone ever looked like they could be a leprechaun, it is Bill Leonard. And he had that little impish smile, and he had a two-word answer. Well, if you knew him, you'd know it wasn't just a two-word answer. He gave two words, and when the laughter died down, then he went into a long explanation. But he simply said, the messiness. That was his initial answer. What do you appreciate the most about being Baptist? And he said, the messiness. What he meant was all of the diversity that is found within Baptist life, both Baptist history and within the denominations and conventions under the umbrella known as Baptists. We've mentioned before that the United States government recognizes 38 different Baptist groups for tax purposes. That's a lot of different kinds of Baptists. You see, there is no one Baptist group and no one creed among Baptists, because to truly be Baptist means that faith, if it is to be genuine, can never be coerced. But faith must be found within the conviction of the individual's conscience. Of course, this conviction also means that there is often a tension within Christian life, and in particular within Baptist circles, between the individual conscience and the community. In other words, the messiness that Bill mentioned. But a messiness in which God is the only true judge. Mary directed a wedding yesterday, and we were at the reception, and among the duties that I had as she was directing the reception, as people got there, and in particular as the wedding party arrived, there were these odd folks. I had to find out which 5 out of the 22 wedding party folks, which 5 had ordered vegetarian meals. And as I handed them out, this one guy said, well, nodding to his girlfriend next to him, I guess we ordered the vegetarian meals too. So as I handed them, I said, that's okay, I'll just eat more meat for you. And I did enjoy the chicken and the beef tenderloin very much. In the passage under consideration today, Paul speaks to the Roman church about how to handle diversity, and especially with those terribly important issues like whether you're going to have a vegetarian meal or not. Because in this passage, we find that there has been a lot of discussion about whether you can eat meat or not. There is diversity within this congregation. But when Paul speaks to them about how to handle that diversity within the congregation, and it's not through coercion, he says, love and grace are the means by which we handle diversity. Paul does not speak here of what group is right and which group is wrong. But he tells the people what is important is their perspective, especially when dealing with others on the issue that may have a different perspective, and how they handle their perspective. Persons within the congregation were disagreeing over that all-important spiritual truth known as what kind of food you can eat and what kind of food you can't. This came about because of the diversity. There were people that ate meat and did not see anything wrong with eating the meat, even if it came from the meat market that was next door to a pagan temple where that animal had been sacrificed. But their contention was, as long as they didn't participate in the sacrifice, it was just as much a sin to let the meat go to waste, waste, as it was to participate in the sacrifice itself. And then there were others who went just the opposite direction, that it was a sin to eat that meat because it had been sacrificed to something other than God. Some of these people were very boisterous and vociferous about what they thought about eating the meat or not. And so with all these different competing religions and philosophies, there was tension within the church. But how important really was that issue earlier, Paul had dealt with behaviors in chapters 12 and 13 that were good or bad in and of themselves. But in chapters 14 and 15, Paul deals with different kinds of behaviors which are good or bad depending on the conscience or the way in which they are practiced. New Testament theologian Charles Talbert writes, and I quote, "They are called adiaphora, that is, matters of indifference. When Paul assessed dietary rules and the observance of days as irrelevant, that is, not of the essence of the faith, he was relegating such regulations to ancient philosophical category adiaphora. It's not essential for spiritual life." Now, while both foods and special days of observance were not good or evil in and of themselves, nor were they indifferent in and of themselves, Paul felt that how people dealt with these differences of opinion was not a matter of indifference. It was all the more important, the attitude with which we approach other people. And the real question was whether one practices his or her opinion, quote, he says, in honor of the Lord and with deference to the good of the whole. Put another way, how do we determine what Christian love requires us to do, and then how do we do it? Especially if it's different from what we want to do. That's the question Paul deals with here. In verse 1, Paul speaks of those who are weak in the faith. And as Gerald Cragg writes, and I quote, "The New Testament assumes the church is a fellowship marked by a common spirit and a single aim, but unity does not presuppose unanimity. Christians may be brothers, but some of them will be weaker than others. Paul expected diversity would not only be one of the marks of the church, but a test of its love." End of quote. What Paul was saying was, people in the church must not use our freedom for the undoing of those who are weaker in the faith. Religious freedom is related to conscience, but it must correspond in action for the good of the whole. There are many different cultural issues that face us today in the 21st century, not just in the world, but in our country, and even in our own particular community. And people take different sides, do they not? With some standing on one side of the street screaming threats at others, while those on the other side of the street scream threats back. They call each other names back and forth. But Paul would seem to say here that rather than acting in such a fashion, whatever position we take may be less important than the attitude that we use in supporting our position. The action we take may be less important than the attitude, because the attitude comes from our heart and says something about who and what we are in our core being. Instead of being judgmental of those who have a different opinion in non-essential factors, Paul reminds these Roman Christians that all persons are ultimately answerable not to each other, but to the God who made them and who gives them life and grace. In fact, to appoint ourselves the ones who determine and carry out God's judgment on those with different opinions when it comes to secondary matters is the ultimate in self-righteousness, against which even Jesus speaks. In the Roman congregation, the weak felt that certain things considered secondary by the strong were necessary, and the strong were judged as lacking conviction. The strong, on the other hand, disdained the weak and put their private freedom ahead of those others. Paul states that both groups are actually in the wrong. because they're dividing over things that are not essential for salvation. In fact, later in chapter 15, verse 2, Paul will tell them that each should please his neighbor rather than self, quote, for the good purpose of building up the neighbor. That's Paul. We should consider others and then act accordingly so that we don't build up ourselves first. We build up, lift up, edify our neighbor. One writer states, Paul prescribes mutual acceptance on the principle that those whom God has accepted as his people must be prepared to accept others, especially those whom God has already accepted. Paul believes that we should be able to discuss issues of our world and our culture respectfully, in church most of all. Andrew Daugherty states, our collective need to be right must take a back seat to our collective need to be in right relationship to each other. Our need to be right is to take a back seat to our need to be in right relationship, especially with fellow Christians. That becomes very difficult if we close ourselves off immediately from what is different and who might have a different opinion. Our world, our culture, regularly divide people and label them in so many different ways. In politics, in social status, in religious belief and practices. As I've said many times before and continue to firmly think it, the two most difficult subjects to teach within a college setting, although I know some that didn't do so well in chemistry or physics that might argue, but the two most difficult subjects to teach have to be religion and politics, political science, because those are things about which people really get passionate. Those are things where opinions are formed at the very core of one's being. Our world divides us, labels us in so many different ways that we argue and shout at each other instead of listening and trying to understand. Listening is not always an easy thing to do, nor is it always a comfortable thing to do. And yet, Paul would contend that that is a part of what it means to be Christian, to be part of a fellowship called out by God, not by each other. And Baptists especially are known for our multiplying by dividing and airing dirty laundry, so to speak, in conventions, in public. Especially with such earth-shattering and salvation-determining things as the color of the carpet, whether to have padded pews or not, what color the hymn book's going to be, or which translation must be read from the pulpit and in all Sunday school classes. Makes you sometimes wonder whatever happened to that old hymn. And they'll know we are Christians by our love. By our love, yes, they'll know we are Christians by our love. I don't know about you, but it seems to me, we'll make one of those nervous statements here. You know, I tell you, it always makes me nervous when people say, I think it says somewhere in the Bible. But this time I think we can figure it out pretty quickly. It seems to me that someone somewhere in the Bible said something like, the most important commandment is this, love of God and love of neighbor. And I think that person might have been pretty important even before he said it. The chief end of men and women, especially Christian men and women, the chief end is to glorify God by life and death. Paul says, so that whether we live or whether we die, we glorify God, for Christ is Lord over the living and the dead. Verses 6 through 9. Part of the problem, as church historian Martin Marty said, is, quote, the problem is that civil people aren't committed and the committed people aren't civil. End of quote. Unfortunately, that was not just a description of what was happening in the Roman church. It happened in the Corinthian church. It happened in the churches of Galatia. It happened in the Philippian church. It happened in the church at Ephesus. And it happens in the church even today. Of course, there's also a movement of apathy in the postmodern era, which does not help the church show Christian charity and growth either. There's a movement of over-tolerance, I think, which is grounded more in moral relativity, where all beliefs and actions are personal and relative based on the situation, than in biblical and Christian thought. But Paul's writings here address those who have no sense of strong moral connection to God, even though they may have civil discussions, as he speaks to support these feelings and this principle of religious liberty where the conscience is free, belonging to God alone. He calls for liberty and understanding of each other, not simply tolerance. Which should lead us not to pride, quite frankly, but to a sense of humility. A sense of humility responding positively to the privilege God gives us to be free, so that the whole might be better because of that freedom. So that love, which overcomes differences, might produce deep worship and praise in our lives as our lives bow to God and give praise to Him daily. Paul says here in Romans that every knee shall bow and every tongue shall give praise. And he doesn't just mean when we gather four times of worship corporately, but as we live lives with our knee bent to God, our head bowed in a prayerful attitude, and our speech lifting up each other in God's grace. So Paul has given us basically here a threefold approach to dealing with differences. And no, this is not one of those, as you already know, it's not one of those 3 points in a poem kind of sermon. He gives us a threefold approach to dealing with differences and diversity within the church. First of all, he says, each person must be satisfied that his conscience is free in God to think about those issues that are important. Secondly, each person is to recognize that if his or her conscience is free, the same goes for every other Christian. And third, each one who is strong in faith is to avoid injuring those who are weak in faith. He or she is to give forbearance and true charity to others. For God is the same toward each one of us, loving us and giving us grace. God freely gives grace that we might be grace givers in both society as a whole, and especially when we are at home in our church. There's some of y'all who love oysters. You've told me. Never put one in my mouth. Don't plan on doing it. But that shouldn't be the determining factor as to whether we get along, whether we work together, or whether we're going to heaven. Rather, the love and the grace that we are given by God is not just for us. It is that we may be grace givers. So that the grace I give to you will help build you up so that you might give grace to someone else, that will help build them up, that they might give grace to someone else, that will help build them up, so that we can all stand together and then bow the knee to the one who gives us grace. And as we stand together and sing hymn number 344, Grace Greater Than Our Sin, that is a challenge. Because we all, well, I won't say we all, I know I like to be right more than wrong. I know that I like to feel like that perhaps I've got a better handle on things than some others. But the challenge is not to use that freedom to think and to reason and to find God in different ways and different places so that I might lord over, but rather so that God's loving grace as Lord might guide me to give grace. And so as we sing Grace Greater Than Our Sin, our altar is open for any decision you might make, even a decision to be more of a grace giver. Number 344, Grace Greater Than Our Sin.